My predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I have read and traveled and thought and written. Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet. And that in itself has been an enormous privilege and an adventure.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thanks for joining us. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we'll be broaching an upbeat, if elusive, topic, happiness. We all want to gain entry to that most sublime mental state, but many of us don't have a clue how to get there. Maybe there are some successful tips to be had. John Leland, New York Times reporter, found his answers in the most unlikely of places. He didn't have to go to Mecca or Tibet. He found what he needed right on his own doorstep. Over the course of a year-long series of interviews, he met and talked with some very savvy, seasoned New Yorkers and discovered that they had great wisdom to impart. So John put all these little nuggets of knowledge into a book entitled Happiness is a Choice You Make. And he's here tonight to share those lessons with us. Fresh from the Big Apple and full of the secrets about everyday happiness, we welcome John Leland.
When I told friends I was going to write a book about happiness, they were very supportive. They said, "What? You? You are the last person to write about happiness." Because by nature, I'm a grumposaurus. I'm a newspaper guy. We don't do happy. Most years, my top 10 list has like 5 movies on it, because everything else disappoints me. And I've used this anger and this dissatisfaction as fuel to get me going. And it worked. I have what I would consider, for me, my dream job. I have a roof over my head. I have a wonderful girlfriend, a very cute dog. I had all the circumstances of a good life, but none of these things, none of them, was making me happy. I was focused on all the things I didn't have, not the things I did. The professional accomplishments I wanted, the washboard abs we should all have, that perfect marriage that I saw in movies or on TV. I was focused on what isn't, not on what is. I even thought about happiness that way, as something that was out there that I had to find or to seek, or maybe some people were just born with it. I was looking at the water glass and seeing only the empty part of it at the top and not seeing the cool water at the bottom. And I was wondering why I was always thirsty. That way of thinking of the world I had to learn was a choice that I made. It wasn't carved in stone. And I'd made it because at some point it was useful to me. It got me things that I wanted, but now it wasn't doing that anymore. Or else the things it got me weren't enough. And I realized that just like I chose that way of thinking, I could choose another one. Maybe I could even choose to see life as being amazing. That was going to take a little bit of work. But from a quarter where I didn't expect it, I found 6 incredible teachers to help me get there. In 2015, I set out to write a year-long series in the failing New York Times about people age 85 and up. They're one of the fastest growing age groups in the country. When I was born, there were fewer than 1 million. Now there's a little more than 6 million. So you guys seem like nice people coming out on a cold night. I don't want to scare you, but imagine if there were suddenly 6 times as many teenagers running around. So with all these older people, I wanted to know what their lives were like, day to day. What did they live for? What got them going in the morning? What were they afraid of? What made life worth living? And at what point wasn't it worth living anymore? And I wanted to know this from the true experts, the people who are living it. Because so much of what we think we know about old age comes from people who have never been old. And it makes a difference. But we don't know what it is because we don't know what to ask. But as one of the women in my book is always telling her daughter, I was your age, but you were never my age. So with the humility for which New York Times reporters are so well known, I realized that I had to admit that I didn't know what it was like to be 85, and I had to find people that did. And my other starting point in this is a body of research that I wanted to understand. And sociologists call it the paradox of aging. That as much as our culture worships youth, older people say they're more content with their lives than younger people do. They're less stressed, they're less afraid of death. Sometimes people call this the U-shaped curve of happiness. They were up high in the beginning, and then it goes down, down, down like this to you, like where I am right now. And then it goes up at the end. And they found this U-shaped curve in cultures all over the world, in poor countries and rich countries, countries that are at war, and countries that are at peace. And it made no sense to me. How can people whose minds are in decline and whose bodies are in decline say they're more content than people who are in the prime of life? What did they know that I don't know? And what can we all learn from people who have lived long enough to know something about life? It's not information you can get on the internet, because the internet doesn't know what it's like to get old. So I began by spending a couple months meeting as many people over the age of 85 as I could. I went to nursing homes and senior citizen centers and assisted living buildings and YWCAs and JCCs and public libraries and book groups, talking to anybody who would talk to me. Enter Helen Moses, Hurricane Helen. Helen found the second love of her life in a nursing home with the man in the room next door named Howie Zimmer. And they're on again, off again wedding plans against gale force resistance from Helen's daughter have been the best running soap opera that I can think of for the last 4 years. Helen is loud and brassy and beautiful, and she's slowed down a bit lately, but until then she was always in a fight with someone or other at the nursing home. But she said she and Howie had never had an argument. You want to know why? Because whatever I say goes. Right, Howie? Yes, it does. Wait till I get you home. Howie is 21 years younger than Helen, but he had a severe brain injury that made him a lot slower than she was. And sometimes their conversations would slip slightly off the rails. And Howie would say, "You're the one woman in my lifetime, I mean it." And Helen would say, with impeccable timing, "I can't hear you, but it better be good." I sometimes wondered what Helen was getting out of this relationship, because Howie adored her, you could see that, but he used up a lot of her energy without giving her much back. And he spoke so slowly that she'd often stop listening to him in the middle. But as I spent time with them, I realized that what Howie gave her was that he needed her. And all his disabilities just meant that he'd need her more. And this brought me back to my mother. My mother says that she spent the first quarter of her life growing up and getting an education. And then the next half of it, she spent working and raising a family. And then she got to the last quarter of it, and she didn't feel that purpose anymore. No one needed her, especially after my father died. And she said she felt useless. She said, "I feel useless. I feel like a useless eater." Well, Helen had been on a similar track, but she got to the nursing home and she created this relationship with Howie where she was needed. And she said, "I take care of him because he's an only child and he had nobody. And then when his mother and father died, he really had nobody except me. I try to be everything to him. I think that I am." So imagine that at 94 years old, wanting to be everything to another human being and feeling like you got there. Helen could not do so many of the things that she'd done earlier in her life, but now she could be everything in the world to Howie Zimmer. If any of you guys know a better definition of a life worth living? I'd love to hear it. So that was Helen's lesson to me about happiness at her age or at my age, to measure your life by how useful you are to other people. And to thank the people who let us help them, because we benefit from it as much as they do, and because there's a kind of generosity in letting somebody help you, and maybe even, as in Howie's case, a kind of love. That's the story of Helen. And that brings me to the indomitable Ping Wong. Ping was 90 when I met her, and she was living on just $700 a month in Social Security. And she couldn't afford the pain medication for her sore joints, so she'd cut the patches in half to make them last longer. Ping had lost a lot. She'd lost her husband. She'd lost her son, who was murdered in China. And she'd lost a lot of her mobility. But she never defined herself by these losses. Only other people defined her that way. Instead, she played Mahjong every day with the same three women in her building. And when she defined her life that way, as a continuing game of Mahjong with friends that she cared about, she couldn't get over how much more comfortable her old age was than when she was younger and working a difficult job and then commuting on the bus at the end of a hard day and then going home and taking care of a family with bills piling up and no time for herself. And that was Ping's lesson to me, that whatever hardships we have, whatever age we are, we have an active say in what role we give them in our lives. We can think they're the centerpiece of our lives, the defining moments of our lives, or we can think they're just things we encounter along the way, like stops on a railroad train. My losses were minor compared to Ping's, but we all have losses. Everybody in this room has losses. They're just part of what it means to be human, like the sensation of darkness or love. There's something we share with everybody who's ever lived, not something that we and we alone are singled out for. So instead of grumbling over my own losses, I started to look for openings to follow Ping's lead and to live for the things I could still do, not for what I'd lost. And this led me to an area that I thought was kind of a total fantasy, that idea of living in the moment, that buzz phrase that you hear, and I never really believed it existed. It's something that I heard from people who maybe I thought smoked a lot of marijuana. But as I started following Ping's lead, I started thinking, that groggy moment, first moment of the morning, you stop and kiss your loved one or savor that first sip of coffee. You step back and say, this morning, this moment has everything I need of life in it right now. Later on, I'll need other things. But right now, this is it. That's the lesson of Ping. There were three more, John Sorensen, Ruth Willig, and Jonas Mekas, and they all had equally life-changing lessons to teach me. They had different health, different wealth, different social supports, different family structure to befriend them, and I figured that there'd be a direct correlation between the circumstances of their lives, especially their family support and tight relationships, and how they saw the quality of their life. But it wasn't really the case. The way they saw their quality of life wasn't so much connected to their circumstances, but the way they saw those circumstances. The ones that saw themselves as the authors of their lives, capable of changing and adapting to whatever came at them, even when it was very hard. They were the ones that were most satisfied with their lives. And the ones like my mother, who didn't feel they were authors of their lives, who felt that they were kind of living as a fixed commodity, and life and old age was something that happened to them, they were the least satisfied with their lives. And this is true at any age. If we think we're the authors of our lives, we don't seek a purpose or joy, we create it. We don't wait for things to be grateful for. We give thanks for another day. The great neurologist Oliver Sacks, when he was dying of liver cancer, wrote, "My predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I have read and traveled and thought and written. Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet, and that in itself has been an enormous privilege and an adventure." All of us in this room have the power to live like this all the time, without having a terminal illness to remind us that life on this beautiful planet is an incredible privilege and adventure. Part of my work has been to bear witness to lives in this late period of time, and part of it has been to say goodbye. Jonas Mekas died in January at age 96. He was the last of the three men I was following. The three women are still alive, and it's been an incredible privilege to spend time with them in this period of life. And if I ever run out of things to be grateful for, I hope I'll always have that. In the meantime, there's this. One thing they gave me is that they all told me that I don't need to be afraid that someday I'll get old. And neither do you. That fear is only benefits the people that want to try to sell you things to tell you you don't have to do it. Stop thinking of old age as a problem we need to fix, and think about it as a resource that it's ours to tap. A definition of despair is not being able to imagine a plausible, desirable future for yourself. Fear of old age does that, right? If we're afraid of it, we can't desire it. And the despair sets in, not when we're 80 or 90, but right now. And it colors all our days on the way there. But the flip side of that's also true. If you can rethink old age as a period of change and growth, and also loss, you can not only desire it, but you can give thanks for it now, and that gratitude lifts up all our days on the way there. It's the difference between looking out the prow of your ship and seeing in the distance an iceberg and looking out and seeing Tahiti. The water around you, both ships, might be the same, but they're having a lot more fun on one ship. A couple years ago, an interviewer asked Jonas Mekas, if you could give any advice to somebody who wanted to be a filmmaker, what would it be? And Jonas's answer was classic Jonas. He said, get a camera. So that's it. If you want to be a filmmaker, get a camera. If you can choose it, you can be it. It's in what is having a camera, not what isn't, all the credits and experience that you don't have. And if you want to be happy, choose happiness. Choose gratitude, choose usefulness to other people, choose to live for the things you can still do, not for what you've lost. It's up to you. You can wait until you're 85 or 90, or you can do it now. As for me, before I'd written a word of this book or knew what I wanted it to say, I was kind of struggling with the material. I wrote down the 6 words that became the title, Happiness is a Choice You Make, and I taped them up my own bed so I'd see them first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And I didn't know quite what I wanted to do with that yet, but just having that there and seeing it every day was a constant reminder that it was up to me to choose how I wanted to view the things in my life, what was important and what wasn't. Happiness, it's kind of a vague word, right? My definition might be different from yours or yours or yours. But the key word in that sentence is really choice. It's a declaration that I'm not defined by the circumstances of my life. I write the story of how I fit into those circumstances. And that declaration is liberating. And that liberation is, I think, the essence of happiness. So happiness isn't the thing you choose. It's the act of choosing. Have you ever thought about how amazing life is? Life goes on either way. It knows it's amazing. It's up to you to recognize that and to live in it. Because what's amazing, really amazing about life, is what is, not what isn't. You can say, I'm going to be happy as soon as all my problems are solved, or I lose 10 pounds, or I get that beach condo in Waikiki. That's pinning your happiness to what isn't, not what is. Or you can say, I have problems, but everybody has problems. That's life, and I can be happy anyway. That's pinning your happiness to what is, not what isn't. Doesn't mean you need to be complacent. You can still go out and change the world, save the planet, lose that weight, vote the bums out of Washington. It just means that you're living fully on the way there instead of being consumed by worry that you're not going to get there. Because worry is a thing we invent to rob us of happiness. It's not real. By definition, it's what isn't. And Jonas Mekas once again put this so well. He said, I never worry. I'll start to worry when something happens. Why worry when it's not happening? And then why worry when it happens? You deal with it. You waste time worrying, and it may never happen what you think. Nothing is hopeless. I don't even know what it means, hopeless. And when I took that to heart and I understood it, it changed me. Still didn't get those washboard abs. And it didn't teach me to lean in. But it taught me that these things weren't really what was important to me. And it taught me to focus on the things that were, especially amid all the maelstrom of noise that we're living through now. Time with the people that I really care about, being useful to others, valuing each day as if it might be the last, because my days are as finite as any of the elders. In other words, it taught me to think like an old person, and I'm much, much happier for it. But as I say in the book, I could be wrong about all of this, in which case I'll have spent all those years living more happily in vain. I can live with that. Thank you very much.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion with John Leland, talking about his book, Happiness is a Choice You Make.
So we encourage you straight away to come up, because I'm sure there are lots of questions. Some are upbeat and some might be a bit more difficult. Go ahead.
So what I heard you say was agency and gratitude are the two elements that you found. Are there others that you haven't mentioned?
I think being useful to other people, it wasn't just connectedness. Those connections had to be meaningful connections. And usually it involves some sense of usefulness to other people. Having a sense of purpose was great. And that sometimes overlaps with religion, because in a lot of our faith traditions, we feel that we're here for a purpose from the start. We don't have to go out and figure out what our purpose is. So those would be the really big ones.
Thank you.
I'm curious, like you mentioned the woman who played Marjan every day.
Yes.
Obviously that was very important to her. Were there certain patterns that you noticed talking to the people in terms of like the ingredients that were part of their lives, that they just felt like by having those, they just felt more alive and just felt, by having that be part of their lives really made a difference in terms of just feeling like they, every day was special, but it created this longevity and this kind of rhythm for them?
That's a wonderful question. The magic wasn't in the ingredients. It was in their relationship to the ingredients. So Mahjong was great for Ping Wong because she had this relationship with Ping Wong, and it brought her to these, and with the three women that she had this with. Jonas Mekas would wake up every morning and he'd stand on his head. That was like, and he'd have a bowl of oats. And that was sort of his way of doing it. And Helen Moses, it was taking care of Howie. So all those things. Howie wasn't so great, standing on your head isn't so great, Mahjong's not so great, but you know, yeah. What matters was what those things meant to them.
Right.
Thank you.
So you define despair as not being able to see a plausible, desirable future for yourself?
Yes.
I was just wondering, for someone who's experiencing despair, what advice would you give them based on what you've learned from these people?
I think it would be to think about the things that they're afraid of and think about how real they are or how much that's in our own head, whether they're inevitable. You know, we see this. I work with a bunch of news people, so they're all involved in politics now, and they're living in a world that might happen but might not. And I think I try to get people to focus on what is and not what isn't, what's really going on in your lives, not the things that you think might happen or might not happen. And I would say that, particularly in the last couple of years, that last line I have about Jonas is about not worrying. I haven't gone through a week that I don't either need to quote that to myself to get me back on track, or quote that to somebody else to get back on track. If you're in despair, you think there's no plausible future, what is it that's making you feel that way? Is it global warming? That makes all of us worry, and I think we should. But despair doesn't help that.
But I think if you're really in a place of despair, you need to talk to another person. I don't think you should ever spend time on your own in that state. I think it's very important because it helps put it in perspective. And that's huge. It's huge that somebody else is hearing.
I'm living such an exciting yet uncertain period of my life. I'm 24 years old. Student debt has never been as astronomical as where it is, and I'm so privileged to have, you know, received the collegiate education that I have. I'm so incredibly grateful. However, how have you combated the possibility of having such high expectations or just the fear of uncertainty, like you're never going to, you know, repay the wonderful parents that gave you almost this life that you have in front of you, and now everything is your oyster? But I find that it's difficult to constantly find joy in your life's work or your job when maintaining that financial responsibility. What do you recommend for someone who's looking to combat high expectations and not feeling like you're rising up to the surface, as well as, you know, uncertainty for what your future unfolds?
Expectations are killers. Where do these expectations come from? Your parents' greatest joy in life is probably that they gave you this great education that they did. Somewhere on the other side of the world, there's another 24-year-old who woke up this morning in Yemen, a widow with four kids. And we're not that person, right? And that person's living every bit as full of life and meaningful a life as you are. So how do we reconcile this? Where is meaning in that life? Where is fullness in our lives, in my life as well as hers? And I think it involves getting out of ourselves and seeing that some of these expectations we have, some of these things that we feel we need to have in order to live a full life, people lead completely full lives without those things. What's different about us than about them?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think we've all got away with things to think about, a bit of wisdom and a little bit of practice for all of us to deal with. Thank you, John.
You've been listening to How to Be Happy, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with John Leland from the New York Times talking about his book, Happiness is a Choice You Make. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and the Ford Hall Forum. Thank you for joining us, and please do so again.